How's everybody doing? It's great to see so many familiar faces, meet some new friends here at this year's meeting. I'm John. We have had the great pleasure of working with most of you at some point in our last 21 years. With me today is my good friend Brendan O'Connor, who's from our partner Quantified Ventures in this new area that we've been working on for the last several months together around bringing social impact investing to our industry. And we think you're going to love this this concept as an innovation. It's literally billions of dollars in found money that could be used to advance our quality agenda and our clinical innovation plans. And you know, the best value proposition that I've had in my 21 years has been with Brendan and his partners and being able to go to our clients and say, if money was no object in what you dream of doing clinically or in improving the member experience, what would you be doing? You know, if you didn't have to worry about where the money was going to come from, what's the kind of stuff that you'd get into? You guys know us as, you know, the plumbers under the sink of the health insurance industry when it comes to government programs. We've got, you know, literally we're organized much like your health plans are, with subject matter experts with a minimum of 15 years experience to work for us in each of these verticals. And this opportunity around social impact investing really cuts across all of this stuff, as I think you'll see as Brendan and I get into this. So we'll review the financing model, and then we'll discuss some ideas with you around the kinds of things that social impact bonds and loans could be used for at your plans or in your parent health systems. And then in the time that we have, we'd be happy to, you know, vet any ideas or answer any questions that you guys may have. Okay? So just to kind of give you the top line, social impact bonds sort of originated as a concept in the UK. They came over here around 2012. These are basically set-asides from large investment banks, institutional investors, retirement funds, who have all these, you know, these good guy, white hat wearing baby boomers putting their money into their retirement funds, and they want some of that money to do some real social good. So this year, those set asides amount to $20 billion in capital that's available for social impact projects. That's billion with a B. And it's just a staggering amount of money. And to our knowledge, our two firms are the only ones that are sourcing these deals in the healthcare industry. And so we're having a tremendous degree of success in getting these things to move forward. And actually, we're working with several folks in this room on their own projects already. There's very few of these that have been deployed in healthcare. A lot more social impact investment money has gone into big environmental projects. And for instance, in DC, where we're both from, our entire city sewage system is being replaced with a $2 billion social impact bond. And with the goal being ultimately to clean up the Chesapeake Bay, which has largely been fouled by direct sewage dumps into the Potomac River when it rains heavy in D.C. So they're replacing the entire sewage system in D.C. using one of these. That gives you a sense of the scope and the size of the kinds of projects these guys are interested in. They generally don't want to bother with projects below 5 or 10 million. It's hardly worth them opening up the checkbook. They have absolutely zero compunction or hesitation writing a check for a $50 million bond, $100 million bond, $200 million bonds are no sweat off the brow of these guys that that Brendan and his partners work with. Generally, the only expectation from these lenders is that you will repay this loan or bond after about an 8-year period with about 5% interest attached to the principal. So it's cheap money, it's other people's money, good to use when you're not quite sure about the outcome, right, and how it's going to work out, but you want to stretch and really reach and try something big and new. And these are very flexible mechanisms where you can structure this as a bond or a loan or other mechanisms that might make sense on a balance sheet. Brendan, anything you'd add there?
No, I would say, again, these are new, which is probably why most of you haven't heard of them before. Primarily, as John was saying, they've been used on social services with government playing that role of investment repayer. But now, you know, we've been spending some time over the last six months to a year of really kind of educating the healthcare space on the potential for this type of instrument to solve some of their problems. So we're starting to see a lot of uptick in the healthcare space, specifically around managed care.
And because the one requirement on these things, aside from, you know, generally principal plus 5% after 8 years payback, is that these be measurable and quantifiable in their results and that they look great in an annual report, okay? So for that reason, because it's measurable or quantifiable, the second that Brendan and his partners mentioned those words to us, we jumped out of our seats because that's star ratings, okay? So virtually anything in star ratings and Medicare Advantage and Part D is fair game for a social impact bond because the government is already measuring and quantifying your results, okay? Beyond that, some of the projects that we've gotten into all sort of fit the mold through different ways, but at the end of the day, they are all going to generate a quantifiable result that screams great social good accomplished, okay? So, for instance, some of the projects that we're working on right now in Tennessee, 1 in 6 Tennesseans is addicted to opioids. 1 in 6. Our client down there has over 70,000 members who are trying to get treatment and cannot get it. So there's work happening there to get a bond to make opioid treatment available on demand within the next 5 years. That's a great kind of project if that's a similar situation in your home market, okay, is one idea. We're doing a tremendous amount of work with both plans as well as with Meals on Wheels around food security and nutrition benefits for low-income seniors or for any senior who's just been discharged from a facility because we know that the leading cause of readmissions to a hospital or to a nursing home are drug overdose or underdose or a nutritional failure because they couldn't afford both food and medicine. So we're working with plans like Fallon and Western Mass that intend to make a universal food security benefit available to all low-income seniors in Western Mass. And then anybody who gets discharged from a nursing home, rehab hospital, or an inpatient facility for 30 days will get 3 hots from Meals on Wheels. And the reason we really wanted to do that work with Meals on Wheels is some of you know one of our subsidiaries and, you know, a big focus of our work has been around risk adjustment. And one of our subsidiaries, Senseo, does house calls to conduct that intensive evaluation to support risk adjustment. We did 365,000 house calls last year, all with doctors. We only get in the door of a beneficiary's house 41% of the time with a doctor, okay? Meals on Wheels gets in the door 94% of the time with a hot meal in terms of, one, improving the member experience, two, getting better results by resolving these food versus medicine issues for these folks, and then three, it's the best clinical intelligence you can possibly ask for when you're in the home on a daily basis. And some basic questions can be asked while they're in there doing the drop-off, and they usually do like a 10-minute social and safety check, okay? So just a couple basic questions like, how is her gait? How is her speech? Did she gain a large amount of weight overnight from water retention so you know if she's in heart failure? And that information will go immediately back to the health plan manager to make sure that those gaps get closed, okay? So thinking about food security and more broadly as a means of clinical intelligence by getting in the door almost every time you show up is a critical area for plans to be getting into. We're seeing a number of our clients interested in initiatives around reducing loneliness because the more you connect especially chronically ill seniors, to other seniors and to other resources in the community. Decreases the likelihood of depression, of course, which is epidemic and is, of course, the big pink elephant in the living room when it comes to the elderly. But we all know that a senior with a chronic condition plus depression is four times as expensive. So in all of these that you see here, adult daycare, we've got several that are going to use a bond to build a network of adult daycare centers across their service areas, as one is nursing home prevention, two for caregiver respite, and three for just continuity of care on a daily basis for folks who really need attention but don't yet require custodial care in an inpatient facility, okay? All of these generally adhere to the principle in Medicare of spend more on Part B and on Part D and on supplemental benefits so that you pay less on Part A and for inpatient and facility utilization, which tends to be, as you all know so well, heinously expensive and difficult to sustain from the insurance side. Any of these things are fair game. Any of the measures that you see in star ratings are viable projects as well, because they're all going to be measured and quantified in their result and result in a payback of the principal plus the interest from either the savings that you're accruing, most generally from Part A. In some cases, like the work we're doing with Passport on the building of their brand new campus, you can also start to generate revenue from these projects, either through stars and getting your star score back up over four and getting the bonus payments. That's revenue that then can be used to repay the bond, through risk adjustment. By better performance on risk adjustment reporting, you're getting more revenue coming into the plan that helps. Or in Passport's case, just even leases on a campus, you know, where they're going to bring in an urgent care clinic and they're going to bring in a retail pharmacy. And all those folks would be paying leases to be on that campus with Passport and their new corporate headquarters. So generally speaking, anything that will generate savings that are quantifiable or revenue that's quantifiable and then can be used to repay the bond plus interest. Okay, good. So obviously the benefits from securing one of these bonds and deploying it relatively quickly, as a lot of these financiers can act, really can have a broad range of huge benefits to not just the insurance company, but also to your parent in the cases of members here of the Health Plan Alliance with a health system parent. So, you know, it does really help advance the whole value-based agenda by funding results instead of activity. And it really does shift the financial risk of developing and then deploying these interventions with other people's money. So, you know, the heavy lifting and the heavy expense of building, say, a brand new capability like opioid treatment on demand would fall on someone else's back, like, the, you know, the likes of a Goldman Sachs or a Calvert Investments or a CalPERS, for instance, are doing more of this work, and, you know, enables you to deploy your scant capital elsewhere. It expands the whole base of effective interventions around some things that we may think intellectually would work, but we don't yet know because we've never really tried it in an actual experiment with you know, controls and test cases. It really provides an enormous amount of money to fund integration between plans and providers. We know this is of utmost concern to this group as well, whether that's, you know, better use of the data that's in electronic health records at the health plan, and then being able to structure interventions around what's in that information, allowing you to do, say, better discharge planning and to get readmissions down to zero. That's a beautiful, quantifiable, measurable result that inures benefits to both the payer and the provider, in this case, certainly to the provider, because you're avoiding those penalties. Using an innovative financial model to address population health issues, the next big frontier for all of your plans is going to be servicing the duals on a much bigger scale than most of you are doing today. If anything comes out of this whole debate around Trump care, it's going to be that 14 million people are likely to lose Medicaid benefits, and the ones that are left, read your parents and grandparents, for whom most Medicaid dollars go to pay for. 66% of Medicaid expense is on behalf of a long-term care eligible population. That means we're all going to have to learn how to manage a long-term services and supports population much, much more cost-effectively. These bonds are the perfect financing vehicles to figure out how to contract with the wealth and range of providers that you need to serve a long-term services and supports population, but have never really done business with yet. You've got vocational therapists and speech therapists and stuff that you may have peripherally done a little bit of work with, but would become de rigueur for you guys in serving a duals population. Doing basic home improvements like ramps and bumpers and stuff that will enable people to stay in their homes longer is going to be another big one. So transportation benefits. Many of you read that many Blue Cross Blue Shield plans are now going to be entering into relationships with Lyft to ensure that seniors will get rides to their doctor's appointments instead of landing up on the ER doorstep. This is the perfect opportunity and financing vehicle by which to advance a transportation benefit. So, and finally, in these projects, the cost of the evaluation of assessing the result is built into the bond itself. Questions so far? Anything you'd add there?
No, I think this next slide will make a lot of this real. So I think the first couple slides that John went over, I think we're going to get the wheels turning here. Yeah.
Have you guys seen any of these bonds used just to strictly start up Medicare Advantage plans? I mean, with some sort of implication that those accrue societal benefits with what was talked about earlier as far as the echo effect goes. And I mean, startup capital for MA plans is expensive.
Yeah.
And so have you seen these kinds of arrangements with 5% returns over 8 years?
No.
Okay.
Not yet. And
let's
I'm not sure they'd, that might be a little tough to sell.
Especially for project number one,
that might be a tough sell. But projects within a plan, as along the lines of what we're talking about, all day. Go ahead, Brendan.
So I think this is a pretty overly simplified diagram. I think before I really start going into this, I want everyone to realize these are not regulated securities. There's a lot of flexibility as to how these can be structured and which stakeholders are involved or not involved and how many of those stakeholders are there, as well as how the cash flow works. So at the top are the investors that John was talking about. These are your impact investors ranging from Goldman Sachs on one end of the spectrum down to philanthropic foundations doing program-related investments on the other side of the spectrum. As John said, about $20 billion in the U.S. alone, growing at about a 23% rate per year. So this pool and this wave of capital that we're seeing is going to continue growing as we're really in the middle of the largest wealth transfer in the history of the world. $40 trillion is going to be coming down from baby boomers to Gen Xers to millennials over the next three decades. And they're a little bit disenfranchised with the model of making your money over here and giving your money away over here, and they want something in the middle, right, which impact investing is. So they're willing to take a little bit less in terms of financial return on investment in exchange for that measurable social impact that we're talking about here, which is why we're talking about that 5 to 6% range. On the bottom right is your service provider. So oftentimes we see these deals done with bringing in a community-based service provider, like a Meals on Wheels, for instance, that the plan would partner with to provide the service. There's no reason why the plan couldn't provide the service themselves and get the capital up front. But these are oftentimes how we see them structured. The service provider, what's required of them? They do something good that benefits somebody, right? They get out of bed every morning, spending 40% of their time focused on fundraising from traditional methods, sending their direct mail to try to make you cry, send them $20, going to the gala, right, writing your big checks. This is a new way for them to get off that kind of hamster wheel of fundraising and focus on driving outcomes. So it's very appealing to community-based organizations who are actively trying to figure out how to better partner with your organizations. Increasingly, we're seeing health plans and health systems recognize the need to structure those types of partnerships. I think the Meals on Wheels example is a great one. If they can get in the door 94% of the time and you can only 40% of the time, how can you think about that relationship in a different way? So that organization is driving outcomes. They need to have some type of evidence base that what they do works.
Yep.
Right? This isn't a startup that was founded 2 days ago with a great concept. This isn't a great model for really innovating and piloting new concepts. It's a great model for scaling something that has a fairly strong evidence base that what it does drives certain outcomes. So the work up front is primarily between the service provider and the payer. And in our world, we call the payer the party that repays the investor. It can be a health plan, hospital system, insurance company, government, whoever that is. The outcomes that that service provider drives happen to benefit the payer. They're not waking up every morning trying to save money for an MA plan, but they happen to by way of what they do. So we try to button up that relationship where we're finding the outcomes that matter to you all, whether that's reductions in acute utilization of care, increase in medication adherence, decrease in falls, whatever it may be. Coming up with a framework for how we're going to evaluate that. So how are we going to measure whether they're successful, and what is the value of an outcome? So if they are successful in reducing a fall, is that worth $500 to you, $1,000 to you? So the work that we do up front is kind of really helping to establish that framework. Helping us there is an independent evaluator. Yep. So they're the referee in these transactions. We're not asking for you to believe the service provider that they were successful. We're not asking for the investor to believe you that the outcomes happened. We bring in somebody like an Urban Institute or a RAND who's experienced in designing and conducting rigorous evaluations to establish causality between a service and an outcome.
By the way, many of you have affiliations with academic institutions that would have an evaluation capability within the system. They love it if you can keep this stuff in the family. And this enables you to, you know, have that relationship with a local entity, if you've got one, that's a credible source of an evaluation like that. And the cost of their service gets built into the bond itself. So yet another way for a plan or a health system to have a closer financial relationship with an entity like that. Go right in.
Hi, as part of these, are you seeing also some value-based construct back to the service provider as well? So in other words, you've got the dollar sign kind of flowing to the service provider delivering the service, but are you also structuring some sort of value-based construct for the service provider themselves so they're more directly aligned to what the evaluation would be running at?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, the next step then is obviously, you know, cash flow. So if the initial investment's coming to the service provider, they're driving real value to the payer. Here's the cool part about the social impact bond. If and only if the outcomes that were agreed upon before the project started are memorialized in a contract, you all signed them, you said if these outcomes happen and we're okay with how we're going to measure those outcomes, if in the project those outcomes happen, the payer repays the investor, their principal plus a 5 to 6% return. If, however, the outcomes don't happen, meaning we were all wrong, we thought they would work, they don't work, something happened, we were wrong, the payer doesn't repay the investors, right? So you're paying for outcomes, not for services, which is a very new concept.
Especially in our industry. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we've seen some innovation here over the last couple of decades of, you know, pay for performance. But there's a lot of constraints there in those types of relationships, especially for community-based service providers who struggle to scale up and provide those services if they don't have money on the front end. Yep. So this is a model that allows for us to get around that.
Can you say that again?
Yeah, yeah. So this is the crux. This is the whole ballgame here.
Hang on, Marianne. We want to capture this question.
The investors are going to give money to this collective organization for this great expansion for social impact, and if it works by that evaluator's perspective, you're going to pay them back.
Yep.
I get that.
But if they don't.
But if it doesn't work, oh well. You don't owe them anything?
That's right. So you're shifting that upfront financial risk.
It feels to me like there should be a catch in there. Come on, John. What's up?
I know.
They're paying for a result.
But if you don't get a result, what if you like get a half a result? You owe them nothing?
That's what happened in the case. There's been social impact bonds where that has happened. And Goldman Sachs, for instance, was the investor in one of them. They deployed $7 million in before they realized. This was at Rikers Island, right? Infamous jail in New York City that they've since shut down because it's such a crazy place. They deployed an intervention targeting juvenile recidivism. Didn't work. They thought it would work. Didn't work. Goldman Sachs lost $5 million in that transaction. And guess what? They funded four more since then. So they're hearing in droves from the people whose wealth they're managing that they want these socially impactful projects. And frankly, we're at a little bit of a disconnect, which is where organizations like ours come in. We have this growing source of impact capital, $20 billion on the sidelines. The number one barrier to them deploying that capital, this was in a JP Morgan and Global Impact Investment Network survey that just came out, is lack of transactable vehicles. They don't have the projects to put this money into. So the social impact bond is one of these new types of projects that can scratch that itch for them. So
the answer is, in many cases, no. You get a half. It will depend on the terms, who the financier is. A lot of the time they'll say, oh, well, and that's the end of it. Sometimes, depending on who the financier is, they may say, well, if you get half a result, then you pay us half back.
Okay, so that's outlined in the agreement.
Yes. But it's not unheard of at all that if there's a negative result, there's no repayment. Because they're buying into this concept of yours and believing that you're going to be successful.
You know, your Rikers example, I think it would make sense if it was a concept that you really couldn't demonstrate until you tried it, and the concept would work. But if it's poor management or if it's something that you misuse the money, I can't imagine they're not going to ask you to give that money back.
Well, the thing about that,
Brendan, let me make a quick comment.
John
Burrage,
yes,
Passport.
Sir.
We're knee deep in this and doing this. You're a little slow in Detroit. We're quicker than you are now.
I hope you have to pay it all back.
And I think, we're trying to build this while being campus. We need a lot of money, right? T. Boone Bicken said, if you ain't got any money, the plane don't fly. So we need money. And we're looking at this along with TIFs and new market tax incentives and foundations and grants, but we're knee deep in this. And the difference, in my opinion, on this one is this is like going into the shark tank, right? These guys ain't going to give you money unless you come up with a well-honed plan. You conduct a lot of due diligence. You know, Greg works with me. He's scrubbing data left, right, and in the middle. And you know what? It's the first time we've ever done that. We just do stuff, right? So this is real business, and you're dealing with real investors, and that's the difference. What I like about it, it gives us discipline and rigor we've never had to make sure the damn thing does work, right? Because we usually launch things, come back 3 years later, how'd it go? I don't know. Forgot about that one. So this is a good thing, guys, because if you lack that in your plan, that rigor and discipline to get through the proper due diligence and execution, these guys are going to make it do it.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing.
Well, and that's often the work. And that's the work that our companies do with you in the development process of putting together these prospectuses and these concept papers so that they're ready for somebody at Goldman's level to really sit down and evaluate whether this is something they want to do. So Shark Tank's
a good analogy. I don't have $100 million check yet either. So I don't have that yet.
No, the $100 million check is not yet forthcoming. We still have a lot of work to do there, John, and he knows that. But it's, so many of the companies in our industry have never had to go do a major capital raise like this. And so the discipline that Brendan and we bring to this is like, is all new to a lot of the folks that we're working with.
Just a couple of quick sort of technical questions. I heard you talking about Medicare Advantage. Have you seen this also in commercial plans? And I guess related to that, is there a tax status issue that matters for these investors?
No, taxes, so for this party right here, doesn't matter. Yeah, there's really no tax benefit there. These are by and large just outcomes-based loans that typically flow through some type of, we tried to simplify this, but there's typically a special purpose vehicle that is some kind of time-based LLC that sits in the middle to kind of shift liability and to kind of flow the cash through. So
just to sort of reframe my question, so the investors don't care if it's a commercial or Medicare, commercial or government plan, and they don't care if it's a for-profit or not-for-profit entity?
Nope.
By and large, that's true. I would say the investors care that the target population that the intervention's focused on, it's probably not a model that should be used to deploy an intervention targeting a bunch of, rich people kind of in there, but even then there are impactful ways that we can meaningfully improve the lives of the elderly regardless of income. So I think as long as you can make the case for the social impact and that you're improving a situation, that's what the investors care about there.
And they're agnostic to who's paying the bill, whether it's a commercial line of business, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, Defense Department. I know several of you are in like the U.S. Family Health Plan with the Pentagon, it is completely agnostic to that. But they want it to look good in an annual report. So, increasing access to Viagra is not going to make the cut. But, increasing the availability of transportation for doctor's visits to prevent admissions all day. Okay, let's keep going. So as we're evaluating these opportunities with you, they are willing, as Brendan pointed out, to sacrifice, a typical return on investment that they would see in other placements that they would make. They generally prefer, as you should, a very tight and manageable number of stakeholders. These are literally projects where too many cooks do spoil the broth. So we want to, the winning projects are ones that are actually real rifle shots in terms of what they're trying to accomplish with few parties that are involved. And one of the reasons I think we're going to get so much traction among the members of the Health Plan Alliance is you guys control the means of production in many cases. Between the insurance company and the parent organization and what your health systems own and control enables us to keep these dollars within the family with a very tight group of stakeholders and producers in this thing to get that quantifiable, measurable result that's so important. They really like projects that are scalable and replicable. Okay, so generally something that's going to be unique to your area, like eradicating syphilis in Louisiana, is, kind of thing a Louisiana financier of a social impact bond would be interested in, but probably not a whole lot of others because syphilis is just not an issue in any other state than Louisiana. Okay? But the idea of a very tightly conceived of adult daycare network, or of the food security or transportation benefits, or a loneliness reduction initiative, all of those things are replicable and scalable in other markets or to a broader population within your own.
John?
Yes.
But you're on that. One of the things that I would consider as you're putting these projects together is in many things you can learn from others that have already been through it, the mistakes they've made, things that mm-hmm. have worked or haven't worked. And
yep.
So being able to put together a network and making one of the requirements maybe of this is that you're willing to share what you've learned in the process would make it helpful for others to be successful and to maybe rapid track some of that. So one, it makes it scalable to take it someplace else, but it's also a commitment. The Baldrige does that as well. Like if you want, then you're open to sharing your learnings about that. And that may not be what the funders are looking for, but you could build that into your portfolio of products to help that.
It's also something that, frankly, to be brutally honest, we're really looking for, because then that enables us to replicate those things with other clients. Here within the Health Plan Alliance, because you guys are so uniquely committed to group learning, and because none of you compete against each other, this is about as perfect as a prospect group as we could have imagined. We already said that they must be clearly defined and measurable, and the common characteristics are relatively limited number of unknowns or dynamic factors that are outside of your control, and the ability to write some business rules which support the infrastructure and the operations that the bonds would be used to build. Okay, so they're going to want to see everything is documented right down to the workflow level. Again, that speaks to replicability and scalability. Okay, anything else you'd add there, Brendan?
No, I mean, I would say, you know, I think a good example is the work we're doing with Passport. These are projects that you can find a lot of different applications for. I hope today we got some of the wheels turning, and there's probably a number of different projects and applications that you would see, but you have to start somewhere. And starting with the most complex moonshot is something we typically advise against. So finding something that's manageable, relatively simple, low-hanging fruit that's going to drive real cost savings to ED visits, to hospital readmissions, that is very tightly defined is probably, as you think about this, a good way to start. Through that process of project number 1, 2, 3, you're building internal capacity where you can go and do these on your own. You don't need us anymore, right? We like you all, but I don't know if we want to work on 10 projects with you. So thinking about project number 5, 6, 7, 8 as being able to tackle some of those more complicated multi-stakeholder partnerships may be a best practice that we could share with you all today.
And making sure that we win on project number 1 obviously is pretty important to getting invited back to do number 2 or 3 or 5. So the first couple out of the chute that we may do with your organization, we're going to want to make sure those things are absolute rifle shots and we know we're going to put lead on target. Okay. So the phases of putting one of these together, first is obviously the big blue sky idea generating session where we're all just sitting around, often with some alcohol or other stuff that will help you think creatively. And you're just going to throw a whole bunch of stuff up on the wall and figure out what are some of the ideas that would be of interest to your organization. We're then going to cook those down into the ones that we know are those rifle shots that we could get a Goldman Sachs to say yes to. And then we're going to run a pretty rigorous feasibility assessment around whether or not we could reasonably expect the interventions and activities that we would be using this bond for would accomplish their result and present it in such a way that a Goldman Sachs Master of the Universe MBA is going to say, oh, yeah, this looks hot, you know, and they're just opening this thing up and saying, boom, that says this is going to work. And then they can run that upstairs and get it funded. Then we get you to the table with the financiers, and it's all about the structuring of the transaction. This is where you really get your CFO involved and really figure out what is this going to look like on your balance sheet, what are going to be the repayment terms, et cetera. And then it's the actual launch of the project and then beginning to ramp up. And then we're off to the races. And generally, these are going to be, as we said, multi-year projects. They typically will run out 5 to 8 years, which is great because, you know, none of these guys are looking for you guys to return this money within 2 years or less. I mean, this is given plenty of time for it to work out. So they take the long view here, and that, you know, we'll be working on success payments upon a schedule if things are working out. So you know, three distinct phases here. We're with you every step of the way as we're getting this stuff built and conceived and then demonstrated, at least in these models, then up to the point of getting the transaction approved and structured, and then your actual execution in making these things work. Anything else, sir?
Nailed it.
Okay, good. All right.
Yeah, so when I think, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of ways that you can get started. I think we have a pretty good process for kind of getting in the door, sitting down with the team, figuring out all these things you've been thinking about for the last decade, what we should be focusing on. But as you go away today and think about this, potentially a good way to kind of hone in on the best place to start is thinking about, you know, for the organizations that operate in a number of different places, where do you want to do this,
yep,
right, from a geographic perspective? So, you know, we're working with some kind of national health plans where they can do this in one of, you know, 20, 30 states. Yep. Figuring out where we want to focus that first one is oftentimes pretty complicated. There's going to be overlaps between these, but where you'd like to get going, I think, is an important decision.
And why you guys, again, are so perfect for these kind of financing vehicles, because your service areas are generally so tight and contained around, you know, your core parent campus that, again, you guys couldn't be better prospects for this kind of money.
And who do you want to serve, right? Is this your commercial market, your, yes, Medicare, Medicaid, duals? Are pediatrics your issue? Are the aging population your issue? Figuring out who those cost driving populations are that you know really have kind of are disproportionately impacted by negative social outcomes or health outcomes. And again, a lot of the work that we do is helping to dig into the claims data up front with you to kind of really rigorously understand what we're seeing historically, and then tying that to potential interventions and solutions. Or choosing an issue, right? So a lot of organizations we work with, when we come in the door, they say, opioids, growing issue. It's we don't see it getting any better. In fact, we see it getting much worse. Yeah. We want to focus there. And if we have that type of line of sight into what issue we want to focus on, we're able to kind of hit the ground running a little bit quicker. But other times, there's still maybe we want to go back and kind of validate that these are the issues that are your major drivers of costs. What is causing people to become addicted to opioids, right, in your area? Are there other things that we can be thinking about to fund job training, improving high school graduation, workforce development, other kind of underlying drivers that can kind of turn into downstream health problems down the road? So maybe just one example here to kind of make this come home. So this is looking at a project we're working on with Meals on Wheels and Johns Hopkins, where if you think about Meals on Wheels, you think about them of kind of coming into the home of a senior a few times a week, dropping off a meal and leaving. That's how most of us think of them, right? Through this project, we've taken best practices from Meals on Wheels programs all around the country, kind of boiled them into one, yeah, program, and used the social impact financing to really ramp it up. So through this project, we've developed a real-time dashboard where the volunteers on their iPads or their cell phones are going to be entering in information that matters to the health systems and that matter to the health plans in real time. In fact, we designed it with Johns Hopkins to make sure that we're asking the clinical targeted questions about their COPD patients, type 2 diabetes patients, CHF patients, so that the volunteers, when they're there on a daily basis, they're capturing the right information that could result in a exacerbation or a trigger that could land that person back in the ED or hospital. We have a case management component to this. They dabble in case management around the edges, target it to maybe 5% of their population. We're making sure through this project we're funding a case manager for every single individual that will be in the project. The degree to which they'll engage, there's some flexibility there. But all to say, we're able to take some interventions that you may think about that have been limited due to funding constraints and really build them up to kind of meet their full potential. On the right-hand side, you see what this funds. This funds Every single cent of what Meals on Wheels is going to be doing throughout this four-year project, from the meals to the delivery to the new vans they have to buy to the case management. It funds internal intervention-related expenses. I think this was initially framed for an audience of health systems. So Johns Hopkins, we're going to pay for two new positions there. We're going to have a recruitment specialist that will be paid for out of this bond. We're going to have another project manager there that will help us keep this on track, pick up on issues. So this could potentially be a way to, these are big projects in a lot of cases, to provide you some additional resources to make sure this project is a success. And it's also going to fund every cent of the evaluation. In this case, we're doing a randomized control trial. These are expensive, $600,000-$800,000 evaluations that philanthropy doesn't want to pay for, you guys don't want to pay for. Nobody wants to pay for these things, which is why evidence, frankly, is so crappy in a lot of places. So this is a good structure to be able to fund rigorous evaluations. And then all the other kind of legal-related expenses that come along with this come out of the investment. So this really is a no-cost proposition to the health plan until the outcomes have been achieved that drive real cost savings or revenue.
Yep. And you guys know, with star ratings already in Medicare Advantage, and every one of those things is measured and evaluated, that anything in stars is fair game. We know that's already happening in the marketplaces. For those of you who are participating in Obamacare, you're already collecting and reporting on much the same data as we already are doing in MA, in the exchange plans. And then we know that it's coming to Medicaid in 2020 through the QRS, the quality reporting system. That's basically going to be like Medicaid stars coming down in 2020. So this kind of value-based payment experimentation on behalf of the government is now part of the firmament in our industry. And when we look at the next generation of measures that are coming, when you look what's on the launch pad at NCQA, at IMPAC, at the PQA, and at the National Quality Foundation, they're all measures in three distinct buckets. It's the chronically ill, it's dual eligibles, and it's mental and behavioral health integration. And that's the future of all of the measures that you'll be reporting to the government, say, in 2023. And yet anything in that area, as long as it's being measured and quantified, is fair game for a social impact bond project. So if your company is struggling with drug adherence for diabetics, or you're struggling with fall risks, or all-cause readmissions measures, all of those things are perfect projects for a social impact bond. Now, one thing I do want to show you, especially this group, is the last Sherlock company reports that came out confirmed what many of us have suspected for some time, which is that 90-style managed care, net of expense, does not work. The idea of continuing to do pre-authorizations and referrals and concurrent review and basically restrictive modes of managed care, net of the cost that it takes to generate those savings, because it does work to some extent, but net of expense just ends up really hitting margin, says that our industry, and especially provider-sponsored plans like yours, are ripe for a total rethinking of the way that we do medical management, and to begin to transition from restrictive modes of medical management to supportive modes of medical management, which are typically very labor-intensive, very expensive, and the transition is tough, makes it perfect for financing through a social impact bond. I mean, on average, MA plans, MedMan costs average $11 to $12 per member per month. That's a lot of money. And so no wonder so many of us have put off any meaningful evolution or upgrade of the way we've done medical management because, one, it's warm and fuzzy and familiar, and two, we just really never had the capital by which to take a completely different look at it. So effective medical management, we now know, is supportive in nature and drives the member's experience, okay? So anything in this realm of recommitting to person-centered care automatically means it's going to be a lot more labor-intensive. It's high touch. What works is not high tech. It's high touch. A client of mine called me the other day to start crowing about how he just signed a $20 million contract with Inovalon to give him advanced analytics. And he was like dancing up and down. He was so excited he got this thing done. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? Give me 20 million worth of social workers and I'll change the freaking world, right? So this stuff is expensive to effectuate a whole new approach to the way that we do this. But when it's done right, it really is person-centered, not patient-centered, person-centered, because it's looking at all the social determinants that drive poor health behaviors. And it's not necessarily physician-driven because physicians don't have the time to drive this kind of process meaningfully. It often is nurse and even more so social worker-driven, okay? And those kind of relationships aren't necessarily the ones that we have in our plants. They're going to be data-driven and stratified, which a lot of you are already doing. As we mentioned, they're very high-touch, labor-intensive, they're mobile, and they're community-based. That takes infrastructure. You're talking vans, you're talking fleets of vehicles, you're talking all kinds of new professionals and all kinds of tools for them to have out in the field, you know, much like a smartphone app for those Meals on Wheels church ladies dropping off those meals that cost money to put that device in their hand to get that information and to make it usable. And that it be culturally competent and addressing those social determinants. You guys want to figure out, you know, the best way to stretch bucks to address social determinants of health, go spend an afternoon at a community health center, at an FQHC. Nobody knows how to stretch a buck better to address social issues that impact health than those folks. They will be your best friends in the context of a social impact project, okay? And generally what we're after, as we said earlier, is that in Medicare Advantage, you're gonna use these bonds to, in effect, spend more on physician services and outpatient care, plus more on meaningful drug benefits and utilization to enable you to spend less on Part A. Okay? So to those of you who have parent organizations here in the room and you just heard butts pucker up at the parent, you know, for the most part, if you guys have been funded and your health insurance company is supported by your parent, then they get that we need to start emptying beds to be successful at healthcare in this country and to be serving these folks where, frankly, they would all rather be back in the home or in community-based settings. This is the money that can help you bridge that gap and to get there. Okay, so that's what we got. And now let's answer any questions that you may have for the next 2 minutes.
Or longer.
Or longer, whatever it takes. Yes.
So a lot of the investments you've described here really are social determinants of health investments,
mm-hmm.
and are addressing the medical expense
manifestation of those
right.
social factors. Yep.
And yet, if you look at the variance between how much they spend in an advanced market versus a traditional market, a lot of that variance is also surgical. It's also diagnostic. And, you know, looking at some of Arnie Milstein's work in the Clinical Excellence Research Center,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of what he's described are alternative models of care that substitute for surgery. You can't tell someone not to get back surgery if you don't have an alternative treatment modality, and if you go down a number of the orthopedic, you know, issues. And so I'm just curious if this kind of funding source would also be legitimate for looking at building some of these alternative models of care to also address surgical and other intervention costs as well as on the medical side.
Absolutely. I mean, I would think there'd be great interest among some of the financiers and you know, if, for instance, if you wanted to address back pain, you know, having specialized back clinics, or with in some of the opioid work that we're doing, we're seeing pain management clinics as, you know, part of the whole process to reduce dependency on opioids and look at other means by which to accomplish that end. So absolutely. You know, there's, you know, I think part of the thing you can get into with surgical stuff is that it's going to be a very small portion of the population that you're really directing those funds to and in the interventions to. It's, there are some surgeries that happen a lot more than others. But, I mean, absolutely. All of that stuff is measurable, so those are fair game.
Right, if you look at joints and, yes, you know, some of the stuff Kaiser's doing with, yeah, joints and alternative joint models as, you know, one example.
Well, that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, one thing that we suspect is going to happen with now Tom Price as Secretary of HHS, who, you, I mean, most of you know by now that Price is an orthopedic surgeon, and he's just this total crank for reducing the physician burden. And that we know orthopedic surgeons as a class of professionals generally hate bundled payments for joint replacements. Okay, so we suspect that all that work that's happening in the Innovation Center at CMS around those bundled payment demos are probably going to get flushed right down the toilet. But these bonds could be potentially a source of funding to do them on your own if those projects are discontinued, as one way of thinking about a potential project. Yes.
Hey, Carter Fagan. John, since you came to see us at Viva back in 2008, we've been on a track of care management, community-based care management, and we're seeing good results. Obviously, you would say you have to continue medical management, or then you're going to get run over by the market.
Right.
But adding on to that, community-based care management, correct, is where you're going with the social workers, which we have done. You know, one of our struggles, though, is the windshield time and how to be efficient with people in the field. You know, some of our studies have shown we see nice decreases in cost after big events with care management, but then it's only 7 or 8% that we're actually saving overall just because of all the misses we have. And so we're going to partner maybe with UAB on some telehealth initiatives and being more efficient and getting out. But I'll just say, I know care management works. It's very hard to prove it works, and it's very labor intensive and high windshield time. So it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
Touch is hard.
That's why we really wanted to bring this money to this industry, because it's time we started proving that the stuff that we do actually works, and we can stand behind the numbers. As Brendan pointed out, it's hugely expensive to run experiments like this in a controlled environment that actually are real results. And, you know, as part of that was our motivation for jumping into this, is we need to establish an evidence base for this stuff going forward. You know, the other being, if we're looking down the throat of the draconian cuts that are being considered in Washington right now, then getting to those results in a replicable way is going to be very important. I mean, if these guys end up cutting Medicaid or rolling back this expansion the way that's being contemplated right now, and even if they don't get it done on the Hill in a bill, then Seema Verma at CMS is certainly going to effectuate it through these Medicaid waivers coming down. And there's 30 of them that got us here to this point, and they're all going to come back up, and she's going to throw all kinds of conditions on those waivers being extended or approved. You know, I think our ability to be able to aggressively manage the cost, especially of duals, because that's where all the action's going to be, is just critically important. And the sooner we can get to that evidence base, the better.
So are you saying block grants are coming, do you think? Is that
Well,
where they're going to go? Or are they going to just redo the waivers and put more requirements on it?
I consistently underestimate what the hell conservatives are going to do. I sat up there at one of your meetings and swore on a Bible that Hillary Clinton was going to win this goddamn election, and she didn't. And then I sat up there and put my hand on a Bible and said, there's no way Trump care will pass the House. And they freaking did. And now I'm thinking, well, you know, they only got 52 Republican votes in the Senate. They can only afford to lose 3. There's no way this thing will get out of the Senate. And we're probably about 2 weeks away from that actually happening. So
you're not I gotta swear on the Bible now.
But I just consistently have missed these projections, and I'll cop to that. But having said that, even if this bill fails, what you'll see is state-by-state waivers where things like per capita caps or block grants are effectuated through a waiver that doesn't even have to involve the Hill. And that's a problem. So if you're in a state that did a Medicaid expansion, or if you're in a state with the financial alignment demos, all of those things are going to get renegotiated over this next couple years. And with Seema Verma, with the rubber stamp in her hand, the only thing that's going to get through is with a much, much lower rate of growth. And then they're going to heave all these bullshit conservative principles like work requirements and drug testing and crap onto this stuff. We want to know what we're capable of before those new, that next generation of waivers comes on down.